Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for Monday, December 8, 2023. Excuse me, it's 2024. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Carol Lockard and Jeff Cassett, and here's Carol with our first story.
Thank you, Jeff. I know it's very hard to get used to a new year. Everything should still be 23. From the local pages of the Quad City Times, join the PAC, P-A-C, on Skywatch. This is by Paul Levescu. I don't know how to pronounce his last name. Check out the solar eclipse in April and learn about space with the Popular Astronomy Club. From its founding in 1936, the Popular Astronomy Club has basically had a two-part mission. PAC serves as a place where those interested in amateur astronomy can get together with like-minded individuals in order to learn from one another and to participate in activities such as observing and astrophotography. Along with being a community of amateur astronomers, though, did I say that right, astronomers? PAC also shares its passion for astronomy with the entire community in the Quad Cities and surrounding area. Public outreach has always been a part of what PAC does, and the club has, for nearly nine decades now, held observing sessions and other presentations that are open to anyone who wants to see what's up in the night sky and who wants to know more about what lies beyond our home planet. The numbers show that public outreach was a large part of what PAC did in 2023. During the year just passed, PAC held 47 public outreach activities, which were attended by a total of 1,793 people. Both totals are up slightly from 2022, a year when we saw the world slowly return to normal in the wake of COVID-19 pandemic. PAC's best known and best attended public outreach activities are probably the monthly observing sessions held at the Nyabi Zoo on the third Saturday of every month from March through November. A few of those sessions in 2023 were canceled or postponed due to uncooperative weather, but those that were held usually attracted large, enthusiastic crowds. Mark your calendars, as PAC will continue to hold public observing at the zoo during 2024, with the first session of the year scheduled for March 16th and the last slated for November 16th. PAC also held observing sessions and activities at libraries, schools, campgrounds, and even at an alpaca farm, as well as for scout groups, churches, and other organizations. In keeping with its educational mission, PAC has formed partnerships with John Deere Middle School in Moline and with Moline Public Library. Both JDMS and the library hosted observing sessions and activities during 2023 and will continue to do so this year. Other groups and organizations have already requested observing sessions for 2024, and more requests are expected. Public interest may be piqued because a big astronomical event coming up this year. A solar eclipse will occur on April 8th. Like the solar eclipse of 2017, the path of totality will cross the United States south and east of the Quad Cities. In this area, about 90% of the sun will be blocked by the shadow of the moon at peak at about 2 p.m. local time. PAC plans to hold a public eclipse viewing session at the Moline Public Library on the day of the eclipse. A similar viewing session held in 2017 attracted more than 1,000 people. And they have a nice picture here of a lot of the people standing there gazing up at the sky with their protective goggles on. Looks like they're all enjoying it. Plan now to attend the session this year or to find a place in the path of totality where you can experience one of the most awe-inspiring natural events that you will ever witness. Club activities include monthly membership meetings held on the second Monday of the month at 7 p.m. at Moline's Butterworth Center. Meetings are not held in August, when PAC holds its annual picnic, or October, the month of the club's annual banquet. These meetings are open to both members and guests and often include presentations on interesting astronomy-related topics led by subject matter experts. The advent of Zoom and similar meeting hardware software has enabled PAC to attract speakers who can make presentations from remote locations. During 2023, PAC meetings included presentations on topics such as the colonization of Mars, extreme astronomy, and the use of astronomical and scientific instruments on the Santa Fe and Oregon trails. The presentations already scheduled for 2024 PAC meetings include one on the Tunguska event, a large explosion in Siberia in 1908, likely caused by an asteroid strike, and one that will be led by the director of the Vatican Observatory. PAC believes that astronomy is for everyone, which means that membership in the club is open to everyone. You don't need to own a telescope or have any education or background in astronomy. All you need is an interest in astronomy and a desire to learn and know more. To learn more about PAC, visit our website at popularastronomyclub.org or find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/QCPAC. To contact PAC, send an email to popularastronomyclub@gmail.com. And the Popular Astronomy Club meets the second Monday of the month at 7 p.m. at the Butterworth Center in Moline. All are welcome to attend. Jeff, back to you.
Boosting Illinois population. A state finds 46,400 people missed by the 2020 census. Illinois may not be losing population after all. An undercount in the 2020 census missed 46,400 Illinois residents living in group homes, an adjustment to the population base that will be incorporated in future surveys, the state announced Wednesday. While the total won't be added retroactively to previously reported census data, the bolstered base may more than offset the nearly 33,000 people Illinois lost in the 2023 annual census update published last month. I'm pleased that the Census Bureau has recognized the undercounting that I and many members of Illinois congressional delegation have worked to remedy since the 2020 census results were first released. Governor J.B. Pritzker said in a news release, this correction will bring in millions in additional federal funding for crucial programs and help to ensure future counts reflect the true number of Illinois residents. State legislators have been calling for the recount of the 2020 census since its initial release, which showed a population of 12,812,508, a decrease of 18,000 people over a decade. That's the first such decline since Illinois joined the Union. A 2022 follow-up survey found the state's population figures had likely been undercounted. The 2020 census provides the population baseline used for annual updates until the next decennial survey in 2030. Resetting that number could boost Illinois' population for the remainder of the decade. In September, the state, working with the research organization NORC at the University of Chicago, filed a request with the Census Bureau for an official post-census group quarters review of the 2020 survey. Group quarters include everything from nursing homes and college dorms to correctional facilities. The census review, which was completed December 29th and received by the state this week, found that 733 group quarters were missed or undercounted in the 2020 survey, identifying 46,400 people that should have been included in the Illinois population count. California and Texas were the only other states to file for a group quarters review. Illinois has a lot at stake in funding in finding every resident, with population estimates used to determine the distribution of over $675 billion in annual state and federal programs. The state also lost one congressional seat based on the 2020 census, reducing its representation in the U.S. House from 18 to 17 members. State representation will be reassessed in 2030 based on population totals from the next decennial census. The 2023 annual census update, released in December, showed Illinois as one of the only eight states to see its population numbers fall last year. The state reportedly lost 32,826 people between July 2022 and July 2023, trailing only New York and California in total population decline. Illinois maintained its ranking as the sixth most populous state at 12,549,000 people, according to the update. The Illinois population decline was primarily due to the net domestic migration of 83,839 people who left for other states, offset by net international immigration, which added 40,492 people, according to census data. While the state found an additional 46,400 residents missing from the 2020 census, the adjustment won't come into play until the 2024 annual census update in December. The increased 2020 Illinois population base will also be incorporated into annual county and city updates beginning in March, according to the Census Bureau. The state plans to pursue additional opportunities to appeal and review potential population undercounts in the 2020 census results, a spokesman said Wednesday. Carol?
Thank you, Jeff. And a little weather news here. Winter storm could bring a foot of snow. The National Weather Service yesterday, Sunday, issued a winter storm watch for the Quad City region that is expected to be upgraded to a winter storm warning early on Monday. That's today. A winter storm that will be moving through the region Monday afternoon through early Wednesday is expected to bring up to a foot of snow, much colder temperatures, and strong winds. Depending on how the storm tracks, the Quad City metropolitan area could see as much as 17 inches of snow. Meteorologist John Hess of the National Weather Service said Sunday night, some of the models are not as heavy with the snow, and some are. If you take the middle of the road, you come up with about a foot of snow, he said. A lot of places will see 10 to 12 inches. Winter storm warnings were issued in Waterloo, Marshalltown, Ottumwa, and Kirksville, which are west of Cedar Rapids and Iowa City. Hess said the meteorologist overnight would likely declare a winter storm warning for the Quad City region during the overnight hours into Monday. As of Sunday, at about 6 p.m., Haas said that the models indicated light snow would begin in the Quad City metropolitan area sometime late Monday afternoon. He said it will be fairly light at first, but by sunset it will be getting fairly heavy. The worst will be Monday night into Tuesday. Initially, it would be a heavier, wet snow, but as the temperature falls Tuesday night, the snow will become drier. Winds will be increasing Tuesday afternoon through Tuesday night, and then diminishing by morning. Some of those wind gusts could be as high as 40 miles per hour, again, providing on the track of the storm. The high winds will blow the drier snow around, making for hazardous driving conditions. Monday's high temperature is expected to reach about 36 degrees, with an overnight low of 32 degrees. Tuesday's high is expected to be about 35 degrees before much colder air moves in. The overnight low Tuesday into Wednesday is expected to be about 22 degrees. Wednesday's high is only expected to reach about 22 degrees with an overnight low into Thursday of 18 degrees. I think El Nino, has said, is taking a vacation for a couple of weeks. It looks like we're going to be in an active winter pattern through January 21st or so. There's like a two-week period with some kind of snow event every few days. Has said the next 2 weeks will be brutal, with a lot of snow and very cold temperatures. If we get a deep snowpack, that could drive temperatures to well below zero. It just depends on what we end up with. To be sure, the snow is not going to be melting anytime soon. The Quad City region was having a warm winter before now, but at some point, Haas said, things were going to change. It all evens out in the long run, he said. That's all the Earth is doing, trying to equalize the temperature. Jeff?
Davenport man is charged with lying on ATF form. A Davenport man is facing charges after he allegedly lied on a federal firearms transaction record in order to purchase four firearms in 2022, Davenport police said. Breon Anthony Humphrey Wellington, age 35, is charged in Scott County District Court with three counts of providing false information in acquiring a weapon. Each of the charges is a Class D felony under Iowa law that carries a prison sentence of 5 years. According to Davenport Police Detective Corey Hughes, on January 5, 2022, Humphrey Wellington purchased a Century Arms Draco pistol from G&G Retailers in Davenport. When he was asked to complete ATF Form 4473, Humphrey Wellington lied about being a marijuana user and provided a false address. On April 22, 2022, Humphrey Wellington again went to G&G Retailers in Davenport and purchased a Heritage revolver and a Charter Arms revolver. When completing ATF Form 4473, Humphrey Wellington said he was not a marijuana user and provided an address at which he did not reside. On August 27, 2022, Humphrey Wellington went to G&G Retailers and purchased a standard Thunderstruck pistol. When completing the ATF Form 4473, he again said he was not a marijuana user and provided an address at which he did not reside. While some states have legalized or decriminalized marijuana for medical and personal use, under federal law, the possession and use of marijuana remains illegal. People who use illicit drugs are prohibited from purchasing or possessing firearms. Humphrey Wellington also is charged with reckless use of a firearm, a simple misdemeanor that carries a jail sentence of up to 30 days. According to the arrest affidavit, on November 16, 2023, Detective Hughes obtained a search warrant for Humphrey Wellington's Snapchat account. A video was located dated July 3, 2023, that was taken from 11 p.m. to 11:08 p.m. In the video, Humphrey Wellington recorded himself driving a gray Pontiac sedan. He was in possession of a .40 caliber Glock handgun. Humphrey Wellington's car Humphrey Wellington stuck the gun out of the car's sunroof and fired it seven times into the air. The cellular location data maps indicate that he was in the area of West 4th and Marquette Streets at the time of the shooting. Humphrey Wellington was arrested Friday and booked into the Scott County Jail. He also is charged with possession of a controlled substance, a serious misdemeanor that carries a jail sentence of up to 1 year. During a first appearance on the charges Saturday in Scott County District Court, Magistrate Catherine Carty scheduled a preliminary hearing in the case for January 16th. Humphrey Wellington was released from the Scott County Jail on Saturday after posting 10% of a $6,000 bond through a bonding company. Carol, back to you.
Thank you, Jeff. And here's an article on leaders announce deal, federal government spending. This is from Kevin Freaking of the Associated Press in Washington. Congressional leaders have reached an agreement on overall spending levels for the current fiscal year that could help avoid a partial government shutdown later this month. The agreement largely hews to spending caps for defense and domestic programs that Congress has set as part of the bill to suspend debt limit until 2025. But it does provide some concessions to House Republicans who viewed the spending restrictions in that agreement as insufficient. In a letter to colleagues, House Speaker Mike Johnson said Sunday the agreement would secure $16 billion in additional spending cuts from the previous agreement brokered by then-Speaker Kevin McCarthy and President Joe Biden, and is about $30 billion less than what the Senate was considering. Johnson writes, "This represents the most favorable budget agreement Republicans have achieved in over a decade." The most conservative House Republicans opposed the earlier debt ceiling agreement and even brought House proceedings to a halt for a few days to show their displeasure. Many were surely wanting additional concessions, but Democrats have insisted on abiding by debt ceiling spending caps, leaving Johnson in a difficult spot. Biden said the agreement, quote, moves us one step closer to preventing a needless government shutdown and protecting important national priorities. It reflects the funding levels that I negotiated with both parties and signed into law last spring, Biden said in a statement. It rejects deep cuts to programs hardworking families count on and provides a path to passing full-year funding bills that deliver for the American people and are free of any extreme policies. The agreement speeds up the roughly $20 billion in cuts already agreed to for the Internal Revenue Service and rescinds about $6 billion in COVID relief money that had been approved but not yet spent, according to Johnson's letter. Lawmakers needed an agreement on overall spending levels so that appropriators could write the bills that set line-by-line funding for agencies. Money is set to lapse January 19th for some agencies and on February 2nd for others. The agreement is separate from the negotiations that are taking place to secure more money for Israel and Ukraine, while also curbing restrictions on asylum claims at the U.S. border. In a joint statement, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and House Democratic Leader Hakeem Jeffries also voiced their support for the agreement. Schumer and Jeffries said it will allow us also to keep the investments for hardworking American families secured by the legislative achievements of President Biden and the congressional Democrats. Finally, we have made clear to Speaker Mike Johnson that Democrats will not support including poison pill policy changes in any of the 12 appropriation bills put before Congress. Now we'll go back to Jeff.
A new tool may boost Alzheimer's drug impact. Scientists have found a way to help Alzheimer's drugs seep inside the brain faster by temporarily breaching its protective shield. The novel experiment was a first attempt in just three patients, but in spots in the brain where the new technology took aim, it enhanced removal of Alzheimer's trademark brain-clogging plaque, researchers reported on Wednesday. Our goal is to give patients a head start by boosting some new Alzheimer's treatments that take a long time to work, said Dr. Ali Rezai of West Virginia University's Rockefeller Neuroscience Institute, who led the study. At issue is what's called the blood-brain barrier, a protective lining in blood vessels that prevents germs and other damaging substances from leaching into brain from the bloodstream. But it can also block drugs for Alzheimer's tumors and other neurological diseases, requiring higher doses for longer periods for enough to reach their target inside the brain. Now, scientists are using a technology called focused ultrasound to jiggle temporary openings in that shield. They inject microscopic bubbles into the bloodstream. Next, they beam sound waves through a helmet-like device to a precise brain area. The pulses of energy vibrate the microbubbles, which loosen gaps in the barrier enough for the medication to slip in. Prior small studies have found the technologies can safely poke tiny holes that seal up in 48 hours. Now Rizai's team has gone a step further, administering an Alzheimer's drug at the same time. Some new Alzheimer's drugs on the market or in the pipeline promise to modestly slow worsening of the mind-robbing disease. They're designed to clear away a sticky protein called beta amyloid that builds up in certain brain regions, but they require IV infusions every few weeks for at least 18 months. Why not try to clear the plaque within a few months, Rizai said, his rationale for the proof of concept study. His team gave three patients with mild Alzheimer's monthly doses of one such drug, Aduhelm, for 6 months. Right after each IV, researchers aimed the focused ultrasound on a specific amyloid-clogged part of each patient's brain, opening the bloodstream barrier, brain barrier, so that more of that day's dose might enter that spot. PET scans showed patients' amyloid levels before and after the 6 months of medication. There was about a 32% greater plaque reduction in spots where the blood-brain barrier was breached compared to the same region on the brain's opposite side, researchers reported in the New England Journal of Medicine. This pilot study is elegant, but too tiny to draw any conclusions, cautioned Dr. Eliezer Meslea of the National Institute on Aging. Still, it's very exciting, compelling data, added Meslea, who wasn't involved in the research. It opens the door for more extensive, larger studies, definitely. Rizai is about to begin another small test of the similar but better proven drug named Leqembi. Eventually, large studies would be needed to tell if combining focused ultrasound with the Alzheimer's drugs make a real difference for patients. Maslia said it's also important to closely check whether speedier plaque reduction might increase the risk of a rare but worrisome side effect of these new drugs, bleeding and swelling in the brain. Alzheimer's isn't the only target. Other researchers are testing if breaching the blood-brain barrier could allow more chemotherapy to reach brain tumors and ways to target other diseases. Carol?
And a little short one on Blinken visiting the region of the war. Hezbollah struck an air traffic control base in northern Israel, the Israeli military said Sunday, and warned of another war with the Iran-backed militant group. The increase in fighting across the border with Lebanon as Israel battles Hamas militants in Gaza gave new urgency to U.S. diplomatic efforts as Secretary of State Antony Blinken prepared to visit Israel on his latest Mideast tour. Blinken told reporters after talks in Qatar, "This is a conflict that could easily metastasize, causing even more insecurity and even more suffering." The escalation of cross-border fighting between Israel and Hezbollah has complicated a U.S. push to prevent a regional conflict. Israeli military said Hezbollah fire hit the sensitive air traffic control base on Mount Meron on Saturday, but air defenses were not affected because backup systems were in place. It said that no soldiers were hurt and all damage will be repaired. And now it is time for obituaries, and we have none, but we do have a pending funeral. Peggy Driscoll, 84, of Tipton, passed on Saturday, January 6, 2024, in Prairie Hills Assisted Living Center in Tipton. Arrangements are pending with Fry Funeral Home in Tipton. Jeff?
Just a reminder, you're listening to the Quad Cities Times on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Moving to the opinion section, remembering January 6th. The first essay, entitled Americans Must Confront the Stain of Insurrection. It's written by Greta Bedakovics. Greta is the Assistant Director of Democracy at the Center for American Progress. She writes, "The chaos and fear wrought by the insurrection on January 6, 2021 still stings fresh in the minds of millions of Americans, and particularly mine, as someone who served as a congressional staffer that day. But as a country, I don't think we've adequately grappled with the gravity of what an insurrection means for our democracy. When future generations look back, how will they view our response? Will they see an America that languishes and yields power to tyranny? Or will they see an America that rose to meet the moment, working to refortify its democracy?" At the time of the insurrection, I lived only a few blocks from the U.S. Capitol. I worked as one of fewer than 20 Senate Rules Committee staff members tasked with organizing the January 6th joint vote counting the joint vote counting session. Many of my colleagues in the building that day, a structure that stands as the physical embodiment of our democracy, feared it would be the place where they died. With the grave consequences of that day in mind, the lives lost and the psychological trauma, we need to be able to reflect on this moment in history with unflinching honesty and humility. If we've learned anything from the January 6th disaster, it's that we can't afford to take our democracy for granted. This means we cannot sit by and watch over it like a relic. We must protect it by constantly and diligently working to strengthen our electoral processes for future generations. It feels surreal knowing Congress will gather again just a year from now to count electoral votes for the 2024 presidential election. It feels even more surreal knowing these votes may again be counted for the same two candidates. While in some ways we're watching history repeat itself, not everything's the same this time around. We're certainly not going into this election assuming our democracy is invulnerable. Congress passed the Bipartisan Electoral Count Reform Act in 2022. This critical piece of legislation clarified language in the original 1887 Act that led to the disinformation and conspiracy theories about the ability of the vice president to subvert the vote counting process. The 2020 Donald Trump campaign widely promoted this disinformation. Since January 2021, many states have enacted measures to securely expedite the counting of electoral votes to reduce the potential for disinformation to thrive. They also have shored up their legal processes for the certification of elections. But much more needs to be done to prevent the subversion of state election certifications. Many states have shifted power to partisan bodies to oversee their elections, creating dangerous opportunities for bad actors to subvert the certification process. The deepening partisan divide across our country has seeped into the administration of elections and threatens to once again interfere with Americans' right to decide how to be governed. This election year will serve as a decisive test for our democratic institutions and the lengths Americans are willing to go to protect or compromise our democracy for political gain. Our election should have no room for partisan interference. We cannot stand for the people's will to be overruled. It is a sacred tenet of our nation that power rests with the people and that we freely choose our leaders. Like many national tragedies, the January 6th insurrection will never be over. It will be remembered by the members of Congress and their staff members who walked back into the Capitol just a few days later, and it will be brought up as a critical point of conversation in every foreseeable joint congressional vote counting session. Perhaps most important, it will forever be a stain on the legacy of American democracy. But while its memory will outlive us, it is our collective responsibility as Americans to ensure such an insurrection never happens again and that we decisively turn back the tide eroding our democracy. We have no time to lose. Carol?
Thank you, Jeff. And we also have another opinion, an opposing opinion by Chris Telgo, who's editorial director at Heartland Institute. On January 6th, 2021, as Congress was preparing to certify the results of the 2020 presidential election, a melee took place at the nation's U.S. Capitol, temporarily stalling the certification process. Later that evening, after calm was restored, the Electoral College votes were cast, paving the way for another transfer of power in the United States. Immediately after the fracas, many labeled the event an insurrection. Others called it an attempted coup. Some even compared it to the surprise attack on Pearl Harbor or the September 11th terror attack. In actuality, January 6, 2021 was a political protest that devolved into a riot. Nothing more, nothing less. Of course, the protest and riot were a dark day in American history, but it was not an insurrection. According to case law, an insurrection is a violent uprising by a group or movement acting for a specific purpose of overthrowing the constituted government and seizing its powers. An insurrection occurs where a movement acts to overthrow the constituted government and take possession of its inherent powers. Though the actions that occurred that day were far from peaceful, it strains credulity to describe what happened as an actual insurrection under the age-old definition of the term. In fact, the FBI determined there was no grand scheme to overthrow the government by thousands of people who wreaked havoc at Capitol Hill. Moreover, no one at the protest and riot has been charged with insurrection. The people were not armed with guns. They posed no imminent threat. They did not have the wherewithal to overthrow the government and seize its powers. While holding a demonstration at the Eclipse that day, former President Donald Trump said, among other things, "I know that everyone here will soon be marching over to the Capitol building to peacefully and patriotically make your voices heard." Those words don't sound like calls for violence, let alone an insurrection. Trump did state, "We fight like hell, and if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore." But he's referring to fighting in the general sense. He was not under any reasonable interpretation calling on his supporters to overthrow the government. What's more, Trump was impeached by the House of Representatives and charged with incitement to insurrection, but was acquitted by the Senate following a trial. Though this does not carry legal weight, it shows that a group of senators with extensive knowledge of the law determined Trump's actions did not rise to that level. Special Counsel Jack Smith has charged Trump with conspiracy to defraud the United States, conspiracy to obstruct an official proceeding, obstruction of an attempt to obstruct an official proceeding, and conspiracy against rights. But Smith has not charged Trump with the Federal Code for Rebellion or Insurrection, which states, Whoever incites, sets on foot, assists, or engages in any rebellion or insurrection against the authority of the United States or laws thereof, or gives aid or comfort thereto, shall be fined under this title or imprisoned, not more than 10 years or both, and shall be incapable of holding any office under the United States. Despite the media's incessant insurrection chorus over the past 3 years and Congress's select committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol, a dearth of evidence suggests those who participated in the riot did so with the ultimate goal of overthrowing the government and seizing its powers. The demonstrators, protesters, and rioters who stormed Capitol Hill were frustrated with the outcome of the 2020 election. They inflicted property damage and violated the law, but they did not engage in an insurrection. Jeff?
Let's turn to sports. And tonight, of course, is the college football championship. Michigan versus Washington. And here's an article entitled, "This Championship Game Has It All." Unbeaten opponents square off in Houston for the national title. Michigan versus Washington is just about the perfect way to end the 2023 college football season, a matchup of unbeatens that hits all the major themes and storylines of the past 5 months, from conference realignment to the transfer portal, with Jim Harbaugh as the main character. Harbaugh's top-ranked Wolverines, with a 14-0 record, face Michael Penix Jr., and the second-ranked Huskies, who also have a 14-0 record, on Monday night at NRG Stadium in the last national title football game before the college football playoff expands from 4 teams to 12. "We're going to have to play really good, and I think our team is ready," Harbaugh said Sunday during a news conference with Washington coach Kalen DeBoer, in which he compared his team to a pack of wolves and, yet again, ducked questions about his future. "Still, the hay is not in the barn. It never is for us. Still polishing, still working, but super excited to watch our players get out there and compete tomorrow night." Michigan's regular season started and ended with Harbaugh serving 3-game suspensions related to NCAA infractions cases. The latter was handed down by the Big Ten in November as punishment for an in-person scouting and sign-stealing scheme the conference determined broke its sportsmanship policy. The scandal dominated headlines just as Michigan was entering the meat of its Big Ten schedule. The accusations against Harbaugh's program led many to question the legitimacy of the Wolverines' renaissance over the past 3 seasons. This is Michigan's 3rd straight playoff appearance, but first time advancing after beating Alabama in overtime in the Rose Bowl. Being doubted and only galvanized a team loaded with experience that came into the season unafraid to point to winning Michigan's first national championship since 1997 as the goal. One of 9 Michigan starters in their 5th or 6th years, linebacker Michael Barrett said, "A lot of guys came back just for this moment." Washington is built similarly and led by the type of star who typifies college football's new era of player empowerment. Penix is a Florida native who started his career at Indiana. He already has a win against Michigan on his resume, but he transferred to Washington to play for DeBoer in 2022. Finally healthy, after 4 injury-ravaged seasons in the Big Ten, Penix has become a star in the Pacific Northwest. The runner-up for the Heisman Trophy had some voters questioning their decision last week when he threw for 430 yards in a Sugar Bowl victory against Texas. "Man, it's a dream come true. To be honest, I'm still wrapping my head around it," Penix said. Penix decided to run it back for 2023 in December of 2022, and a bunch of talented teammates followed, such as All-American receiver Rome Adunze, and defensive end Braylon Trice, and offensive tackle Tony Fautanu, both third-team All-Americans. He kind of led the charge, and a lot of guys chose to go down the same road, DeBoer said Sunday. I think they just really firmly believe that there was more left out there for this football team. It helps these days that college players can make some extra money off their fame and be compensated for name, image, and likeness. NIL collectives for both schools concentrated efforts on retaining their established players. The combination of NIL money and loosening transfer rules seemed to tip the balance of power in college football this season. After years of the same small group of teams locking down the majority of playoff spots, the Southeastern Conference teams, or Clemson winning 8 straight titles, the top tier of contenders grew, but too soon for the CFP to accommodate all the deserving teams. The 4-team playoff will go out as it came in, with a Big Ten versus Pac-12 championship as Washington plays the final Pac-12 football game for the conference as it's currently structured. During the 3 weeks leading into the 2023 season, the Pac-12 was plundered by its Power 5 competitors. Ironically, the conference then went on to have its most entertaining and competitive season in years, with the Huskies snapping a 6-year Pac-12 playoff drought. The Huskies will try to win the Pac-12's first national title in football since Southern California in 2004. A parting gift of sorts for the league it helped found in 1915. Washington's last national championship came in 1991. The Huskies will join the new coast-to-coast Big Ten this summer, and in 9 months will welcome Michigan to Seattle for a conference game. Whether Harbaugh will still be the Michigan coach by then remains to be seen. Presumption and speculation has been that for the third straight year, he will draw interest from NFL teams. Harbaugh spent 4 years with the San Francisco 49ers, leading them to a Super Bowl against his brother John's Baltimore Ravens, before returning to his alma mater in 2015. It took a while, but the 60-year-old Harbaugh has delivered on the high expectations he brought to Ann Arbor. And despite the tumult off the field, Michigan would like to keep him around. The uncertainty about Harbaugh, especially with even more NCAA-related penalties possibly looming for him in Michigan, has given his Wolverine season a last dance vibe. Everything is right here, in front of us, coming down the straightaway, like a thoroughbred, Harbaugh said. You can see the finish line. Got the blinders on. Each guy, I'm just going to the whip. Carol, back to you.
Thank you, Jeff. And a little women's basketball. Illinois Wesleyan, 98. Augustana, 59. The Titans splits the Vikings. A horrendous start was costly for the Augustana College women's basketball team Sunday afternoon. The Illinois Wesleyan Titans proved their number 13 national ranking in rolling the Vikings 98-59 at the Carver Center. IWU shot a torrid 61.5% from the field in the first half of the CCIW contest after opening the game at 65% clip in the opening 10 minutes. Between that and a hawking, pressing defense that forced 26 Viking turnovers, it was no contest by the end of the first half when the Titans built a 61-33 lead. They are number 13 in the country for a reason, Augie coach Mark Beinborn said of the Titans. They were extremely aggressive right from the start, and they came out swinging. We looked stunned. The Vikings, 8-6 and 4-2 in CCIW, led 3-0 on Carly Stone's opening three-pointer, and trailed just 12-11 when Callie Pepez scored off a Corey Whitlock feed with 5 minutes and 35 seconds left in the first. After that, though, the Titans turned up the pressure and held the host to just 2 buckets the rest of the frame. We handled that press well at times, and then all of a sudden there were 3 turnovers in a row, Beinborn said. That's what presses tend to do, and that first led to IW points in the final 5 minutes of the stanza when the Titans went down on a 22-4 spree for 34-15 lead after the first quarter. I have to be honest, I think that was one of the prettiest first halves of Illinois Wesleyan women's basketball I've ever been a part of, longtime IW coach Mia Smith said after her club moved to 12-2 and 5-0 in the CCIW race. She said, I thought we shared the ball in such a timely and accurate manner, and that really created great shots for us. Smith, who watched her team hit 13 of 32 three-point attempts and 15 of 19 free throws, admitted that she had no idea her team was ready for an effort like that in its first game back from break. It resulted in all 5 IW starters scoring in double digits. Mallory Powers, an Amboy High School prep, led the Titans with a game-high 17 points to go with a team-high 8 rebounds and 6 assists. Ava Bardick added 16, Kate Knutson 15. Both Sawyer White and Kate Palmer tossed in 14. IW scored 33 points off Augie's turnovers and put up 44 points in the paint as they converted numerous fast breaks. Beinborn said they got that lead and left us playing from behind. That's a team you really can't play from behind against. Papez, a slender 6'3" sophomore forward, battled inside to finish with a double-double of 12 points and 10 rebounds to lead Augie's 36-35 rebounding advantage. Whitlock added 11 points for the Vikings, who shot a solid 44.4%. That's 24 of 54 for the game from the field. Jeff?
Well, Carol, I guess the Augie men's team didn't do much better than the women. IWU flexes its muscles. The Titans' defense uses size and strength to beat the Vikings. Illinois Wesleyan came into Sunday afternoon's CCIW contest at Carver Center leading the league in defense and lived up to that reputation, making it very difficult on the Augustana College men's basketball team. With a long and strong lineup, the Titans stymied the Vikings, taking a 77-64 league victory before a nice-sized matinee crowd. IWU came in leading the league, allowing just 64.9 points per game, and has allowed only 3 foes to reach 70. They're big, they're physical, and we know that they're going to try to come out and hit us hard and hit us often and use that size against us, Augie acting head coach Jordan Delp said. Give credit to them. They do a nice job defensively, and we knew that coming in. We as a staff have to have them more prepared to attack. The Vikings battled early through 6 ties and 10 lead changes. Augie senior Tyler Knuth, who scored a game-high 19 points, forged a tie at 20, finishing a drive with 7:56 left in the half. From there, though, the Titans, who are 8-6 and 4-1 in the CCIW, proved why they were one of the preseason favorites in the league. They answered with 2 quick buckets, a Trey Buzzell 3-pointer from the right wing in front of the Augie bench, and Ryan Stroka's drive to take a 25-20 lead to the 7:01 mark. That jump started a 20-10 run to close the half and left the hosts down 40-30 at halftime. They ran a stretch of zone defense against us, both in the full court and at half court, that bogged us down, Delp said. That was a really nice adjustment by them. We know they like to run that 1-2-2 flathead defense, and we prepared for it. But they really did a nice job of executing and making it hard on us to penetrate the ball. We settled a little bit, and that allowed them to extend their lead when we weren't matching their stops. In that stretch, the Vikings missed 7 shots and turned the ball over 3 more times. When we get our defense, set, especially because of our size and length, that's our strength, veteran IWU coach Ron Rose said. Augustana got us a little bit in transition when we were changing defenses a little bit and didn't do a very good job of communicating, and they burned us on that when we weren't on the same page. That Titans defense was usually on the same page, and that frustrated the Vikings. While Augie shot 47.2% that on 25 of 53 from the field, the Vikings were only 6 of 20 from three-point range and were out-rebounded 31-20. Mike Hamilton led Augie's board work with 6 while scoring an equal number of points. Both starter Chase Larson and reserve Evan Ambrose added 10 points for Augie, which hosts Carroll at 7:15 on Saturday in the women's men's twin bill. On the other end, IWU pounded the ball in the paint and shot 60.8%, 31 of 51 from the field, as it scored 42 points inside compared with Augie's 22. We're really a high percentage shooting team from inside the arc, Rose said. Augustana is running that zone defense, and we've got a couple of guys that are good high post, and we had success when we were able to get the ball there. Well, that brings us to the end of the Quad City Times for today. I'm Jeff Cassett. My partner at the microphone has been Carol Lockhart. You can listen to Iris programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening to Iris, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.